Whether you think you can or you can't, you're right. Hello and welcome to the I Could Never Do That podcast. I'm Carrie Barrett, and these are the stories of people who have gone into the arena and fought hard to achieve the unthinkable in spite of the fact that, yes, sometimes they are scared and do have some insecurities. Are you ready to go in? It's my hope that after hearing some of these interviews with thought leaders and artists, athletes, musicians, and entrepreneurs, that maybe you too will be able to go from, I could never do that, to, you know what? Maybe I can. You know those phrases, sometimes you're the windshield and sometimes you're the bug, or sometimes you're the hammer and sometimes you're the nail? Well, from the fall of 2021 until, well, now, my guest today, for the most part, has been the nail. She has been the proverbial bug on the windshield, as it were. But let me just give a couple of headlines from the past 2 years of Emily Ballinger's life. Shock pains in her face, the Berlin Marathon, pregnancy, miscarriage, pregnancy, selling of a business, brain tumor, birth, brain surgery, London Marathon, and the completion of the 6 World Marathon Majors. Massive, massive highs and deep, deep lows, all in the last couple of years. And I won't say too much in this intro, as we go way in depth on each of these curveballs or knuckleballs or change-ups or whatever sports euphemism you want to put on it, these events that would throw any of us off balance, literally and figuratively, she has used to actually create a foundation of stability of what's important in her life. And that's the inherent lesson today that I took away from this I Could Never Do That. Any moment that is profoundly difficult is also an opportunity to discover a deep sense of purpose and gratitude. So with that, please welcome Emily Ballinger. All right. Well, Emily, thank you for coming over to the podcast studio.
My pleasure.
AKA a very echoey kitchen table. I'll have you know, I did turn off the water fountain that is like my cat's water feeder so that it doesn't feel like we're in some oasis somewhere with a babbling brook in the background. But you and I have been trying to plan this for a while. Mm-hmm. Our paths cross about every Tuesday and Thursday with Gilbert's Gazelles, our running group. And it's sort of where I want to launch into this conversation today, because we first met in 2019 when we were both training for the Boston Marathon with Gilbert's Gazelles. And there was a little click of us that bonded, that did that race and successfully completed it. And then, you know, what I remember from you during that time is very type A driven athlete, business owner. You ran a bar studio, you owned it. You were very diligent about your training, almost to the point of like injury and, you know, just grinding it out. Yeah. Which sounds familiar, by the way.
Right. Like,
that is me looking in the mirror as well. And then the pandemic happens, so we all go our separate ways for a while, and I was out of Austin for a bit, and next thing you know, I'm scrolling through the Facebook, as we do, and I see you start posting about, A, you're pregnant, okay, that was a surprise, and then shortly thereafter, you reveal publicly that you'd had a brain tumor, and that you'd had surgery just months after giving birth to your son, and that you were telling everyone in a warning, saying, hey, I just want you to know I'm going to be out there, but I'm not going to look the same. You might see me walking with a cane. My speech has been affected. And so just go easy on me, mm-hmm. but know that I'll be there. Mm-hmm. And that blew me away. So I like to fill in those gaps. So go. So if I could just, by way of the timeline of how all of this happened so quickly, I'm going to go in the order in which Runner's World did a great piece on you, and I'll link that in the show notes. And so I'm just going to highlight some of the dates that they mention.
Okay.
And let's fill in some gaps with emotion. Let's fill in some gaps with what was really going on. And so they mentioned that in September 2021, you started to experience these weird electric shocks.
Yes.
And these weird sensations yes. on the right side of your face.
Yes.
What was going on?
So that's interesting. I was training for Berlin. I was right at the end of my training for the Berlin Marathon. And I started having these electric shocks on the side of my face. It sounds weird saying electric shocks. Now I know that is nerve pain, but which we all may have experienced on other parts of our bodies. But that it was at first just a little twinge. And in fact, I thought it was something with my, like I had a cavity or something, because it was really located around my mouth. And so knowing that I was traveling to Berlin in just a few weeks, I immediately got into the dentist, because I didn't want anything to happen in Berlin where, you know, no insurance. Yeah. I didn't know what was going on.
Yeah.
So I went to the dentist and they couldn't find anything. And, you know, ongoing, referred me to a specialist, couldn't find anything. And eventually the specialist referred me to a neurologist. Well, the appointments for the neuro, and that was really more for like a nerve pain. They weren't putting any label to it. By this time, the neurologist appointment was months away.
Of course.
Okay? So yes. I can't even remember if I made one or not. I kind of think I didn't, because this pain would just come and go. So it was very like one day I was fine and the next day I would have these shocks. And when they'd leave for months.
Okay.
It was just something that I thought it was swelling or something like that.
Yeah, you could chalk it up to just everyday stress. You are
exactly.
a business owner.
And during that time, it was 2021. Of course, in 2000, I'm a small business owner with COVID. I had never been under so much stress. I had a miscarriage during the pandemic. I actually had a miscarriage and closed my studio on the same day for COVID. It was intense. And, you know, that time leading up to Berlin had just been spent trying to save my business and, you know, keep it from closing. And it was a super stressful time. So it could have been anything. Yeah. And then really being at the end of my marathon training. I mean, we know how intense that is. So yeah, it could have been a ton of things. But during this time where I was waiting for a neurology appointment, I headed to, you know, Dr. Google. And I could pinpoint it when I started doing these search on electrical shock feelings in the face. And because by that time they were spreading like over, like in my jaw, over my lip, over my brow. So there's definitely like a nerve pattern there. And I was experiencing symptoms of trigeminal neuralgia. And they call that the suicide disease because it's so painful that Whoa. People just can't take it. And at that point, that was very scary. And what I read on Google was that it can largely be you can either just have trigeminal neuralgia. It can be a pinched nerve or something like that. It can also be a warning sign of MS. And in less than 1%, it can be a tumor. Well, I actually
less
thought
than 1%.
Less than 1%. So that was out the window, right? Never mm-hmm. even considered that. I thought I might be getting MS. And then I got pregnant, and pregnancy was fine. And, but then, these shocks just started getting worse. I remember we were on our baby moon and it was to the point, I mean, it was, I couldn't talk by at this point I could, because I thought, I felt like I would just have be talking to someone and have these shocks where it would just stun me. It's like someone would stick a stun gun to my face is the only way I can explain it.
Oh my gosh.
And it was debilitating. And then I didn't want to eat. And I didn't, it was really hard because there I was 32 weeks pregnant. I had to eat. I had to drink. I had to talk, you know, and that was really tough. And that's when we were on our way back from Florida in a car. And I called my doctor here in Texas and I'm like, so somebody has to do something. I can't wait for this neurologist anymore. The pain is so far off. I mean, I just, I, you know, so my just family doctor got me in and he got me in for an MRI the very next day and they found a brain tumor.
It was, and you were the 1%.
I was the 1%. And interestingly, I was relieved. My family, because I had at this point had read so much about trigeminal neuralgia and I just knew I couldn't live like that. I mean, I could very well see why it was called the suicide disease.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was already having crazy thoughts and I never did. It was just like, you know, it was just crazy.
Yeah. So it's the fear of,
yes,
of not knowing, but getting a diagnosis of tumor, which did you know at the time that if it was a tumor, whether it was a malignancy or a benign tumor, you just knew you had a mass.
I knew I had a mass. And they had found, that they had found a tumor that was most likely pressing up against these nerves, and that was causing the trigeminal neuralgia. So the MRIs, then they were, okay, now I can really see my neurologist now. He got, I mean, I had this
funny
one
how
doctor.
That appointment opens up.
Exactly. Yeah. Once this family doctor, he saw me. The only times I've seen him is for my post-marathon colds. I don't go to the doctor often, but he really took an interest. And I was real lucky because I was at 32 weeks. I was into my third trimester where I could take some medication. It was a really hard choice. But had I been any earlier in my pregnancy, I wouldn't have been able to take the medication that I needed. So the symptoms, we were able to get the symptoms a little bit more under control so I could finish out my pregnancy. And that was what they wanted to do. At that point, I had been to a neurologist. We had discovered that the tumor was benign. But the location of it was not ideal for two reasons. One, it was causing the trigeminal neuralgia. But two, it was starting to envelop my brainstem. They were surprised that I had use of my arm and my leg at all. While it wasn't like I needed surgery that day, it was important that it was removed before it got any more, you know, enveloped within my brainstem. Because obviously surgery at that point would maybe not even be an option. And that would just cause all sorts of things.
No, yeah. And you're 32, 33 weeks pregnant when you find this out. If I could back up a little to the extent that you're comfortable chatting about, you mentioned you had a miscarriage and then suddenly you're pregnant. And it also says in this article, and you're very transparent about it, that at the time you were 45, 46 years old when all of this is happening.
Yes.
So, late stage pregnancy. What do they call it?
Geriatric pregnancy.
They've really cushioned the blow on that one. Not even late stage pregnancy.
Geriatric.
Might as well just say old broad pregnancy. Really, just make it feel great. Obviously being pregnant and subsequently having Beau, your son, like this was a planned pregnancy. Did you and your husband, like, did you try for this? Were you doing IVF? Like, what were some of these measures, if you want to chat
absolutely
about it?
So, after the Boston where we met was my second Boston. After my first, we had, which was in 2015, we had talked about, you know, I got married later in life. Mm-hmm. I think I was 38 when I got married. So, you know, like any other couple, you want to have those years, you know, together, and we weren't, hell-bent on having children right away. Now I'm, you know, after everything that's happened, I might have I might rethink that. Yeah, no. But
never.
But it is funny. So we had never really tried to get pregnant. But by the time I told my doctor, "Hey, I'm ready to have a kid," I was in my 40s, and we were immediately pushed into IVF. So we never even tried naturally. So, I mean, I went through two rounds. I mean, I did some IUI. We did two rounds of IVF and were unsuccessful. What we learned was that for my age, I produce a ton of eggs, more so than your average 40-something.
You go, geriatric woman.
Yeah, I know. But I said my eggs are geriatric. I, like, pictured my eggs being these little old ladies. I mean, yeah, you know, they just were not up to the, they weren't ready for the game.
Yeah.
So, so we, during COVID, it's interesting. We, at this point, we were still trying naturally. And, I did get pregnant. Now, the sad part of that story was that I didn't really realize I was pregnant until I was having the miscarriage. I think with all the stress, I didn't even realize I hadn't started my period. I was, almost 8 weeks. And, when I, this event just started happening. Yeah. And I realized this was not my period. This was something else. And, as I found out I was pregnant, I was also losing the baby.
Wow.
So it was, that was tough because I had finally been pregnant. And even if it was for only 8 short weeks, I would have liked to experience that joy. But then I thought, was this my saving grace? Because I didn't know. So I don't, you know, that was hard. I still don't even know that I have really come to terms with what all that meant. But I, you know, at one point started thinking, well, this just showed me that I could get pregnant, you know? So we tried IVF again. Mm-hmm. Nothing. And when I say nothing, we would get some eggs. Anyone that's going through this knows that, you know, you see how many, you do the 14-day wait or 7-day wait, see how many of your eggs survive, and then they go off to, the word isn't coming to me, genetic testing.
Okay.
And you have to pass that. Mm-hmm. Right. And I just couldn't. Through all of that, I think we had 100 eggs through 3 rounds of IVF. We had 100 eggs. I had one that passed genetic testing. We implanted it before I ran Tokyo or after I ran Tokyo, after Boston. And it didn't take. So at that point, we had really just, we were done, mm-hmm. you know? And then after I ran the Berlin Marathon, really after these shocks, we come home. I had a great race there, and we were like, let's give it one more shot. I had a friend that was like, you want a baby of your own? We've been praying hard for this, and started praying for a miracle. And we got pregnant, and it truly was a miracle. We just one time.
Wow.
One time, and here he is. We really just did not expect it at all. And of course, having experienced what I've experienced once we were pregnant, you know, I that journey for me, I was in fear most of the time. I tried to enjoy it. But then once I started enjoying it, here came the brain tumor. It was just this interesting, you know, dynamic of ups and downs. And but I never was lost on the fact that I was pregnant. And truth be told, I never expected it to happen. Mm-hmm. I was waiting for the miscarriage because I just knew, or truthfully, I was expecting him to have Down syndrome or certainly not expecting to have a, what one would say, quote unquote, healthy baby, right?
Yeah.
But here he is, healthy as a horse. And every day I look for something wrong with him.
Oh, no. Yeah. That, jokingly, the other day on a run, you're like, oh, yes. This kid thing getting in the way. It's He's perfect. And he's just ruining your running schedule.
Totally ruining it. Yeah.
At this point. But so he was born in July.
Yes.
2022.
Yes. Yes.
And so 3 months later.
Exactly. Yes.
So you haven't even had a night of sleep at this point. 3 months later in October-ish is when you have this surgery to remove the brain tumor, or the surgery to hopefully remove the brain tumor, as it were, because they weren't sure if they were going to be able to get it all, right?
That's right. Yeah. That's right. And yes, and you know, I look back on that and I was making plans. I was like, okay, I got 2 weeks, right? This, I'm going to be in the hospital 3 to 4 days. That's what I kind of thought. I'll give myself a week and a half recover. And I mean, I was covering, you know, girls that couldn't teach at the studio. I was like, I got your class, you know, 2 weeks later, and never in my wildest dreams. And so I don't know. Was that my way of coping with it all? Did I really not know? I haven't quite figured that out yet. But yeah, I was in the hospital for 8-9 days. And I'm still working on my recovery, you know, but they did go in, and they were glad they went in when they did. And because it was the brainstem again issue, but they said it came out the way this tumor looks is that it's like, they say it looks like pearls, but it's encased in this, you know, whatever. Cells, and they were able to really get it out and in solid, you know, pieces, where it came out nicely, however that works. Yes. Yeah. And so it went as well as they could have expected. And they can never say they removed it all, because, you know, cells are microscopic. There's going to be things that are left behind, but they, and then again, you know, the ultimate goal here was to relieve my symptoms, which it did.
Oh.
So our prayers were answered. The tumor gone. Yeah. The symptoms were completely gone. I have not had one since, any sort of shock. Now what we did find out is, because of these little cells that are left behind in this particular type of tumor is known to come back. And it's for whatever reason, it's a 7-year stint. Now that's hard for me to understand, because it turns out I've had this tumor my whole life.
Really? How can they tell that? How do they?
It's
they
the,
can
just the type of tumor it is. They know it, you can get these at birth. They don't typically cause any symptoms. They're benign, right? But I think, you know, the reason mine was all location. It was just in a bad location. And so they are telling me that I will probably have to go through this surgery again at some or multiple times in my life, which is a bummer. But I did just get my annual MRI scan in January, and there have been in the past year, which it's been a year, you know, a little over a year, there's been no new signs of growth. So we're right where we want to be this year. So
you're 1 year in.
1 year in, nothing there. Still empty up there. So I can, you know, it's not like I think about it every day. It does weigh heavy on my mind that, you know, this recovery has been so hard. And the older, 7 years from now, it's going to be harder. And so I worry about that. And I worry about, you know, I remember when I woke up from the surgery, I looked at my mom and I was like, do my legs still work? You know, because when we're working in your brain and around your brainstem, you know, I worry about where it will grow back. Hopefully, like, not on my brainstem, but you just don't know. But so when I'm thinking about my life and things, I guess it weighs a little bit on my mind, like, I should do this now.
Yeah. Yes.
But I also am realistic. Like, this is a long time away, and I can't worry about this every day. And most importantly, I'm so lucky that it's benign, and I'm not here in a cancer, fighting cancer. Interestingly, a month later, a very good friend of mine, a bar 3 owner friend here in Austin, also was diagnosed with a brain tumor, and hers is cancerous. Mm. So yeah. I have seen very closely, you know, what could have been, and I'm very grateful, very grateful. Even through the crummy parts of all of this, I always have gratitude.
Yeah. And do you said an annual scan. How often are they scanning? Is it just once a year that they're scanning at this point?
At the beginning, yeah. It was, I think I went every 3 months.
Okay.
But at this point, they feel comfortable because it is a slow growing tumor. So they feel like I've been promoted to annual MRIs. Yeah. So every December, I have these like right
Happy
after
New
Christmas.
Year.
Happy New Year to me, you know. And yeah. But I, you know, I kind of scheduled it that way. I get the scan in December, and then I go to the doctor, and they discuss the results with me in January. And I've decided this is kind of what I want to do. So I kind of can in January know what I have to deal with that year, and just go from there. So
you know when. On that Facebook post I mentioned at the beginning, and you were very transparent about saying, I might look different. Mm-hmm. I've lost some balance. My speech is a little difficult. Clearly, I'm not sensing any of that at this point. How long did it take you to get over some of those humps of that recovery from the surgery?
Well, I've come a long way. You know, I was when I talk about or mentioned previously that I was looking at this being a 2-week ordeal. I mean, my gosh, I had no earthly idea I'd be leaving the hospital on a walker. I couldn't walk. And really, I think it wasn't that my legs weren't working. It was, I mean, probably a combination of being in a hospital bed for 9 days, but also it was my balance. I was having a rough time, and it really impacted my, I heard someone, I've never had vertigo, so I don't really know what that is, but I heard someone kind of describe it like that. It was a vestibular issues.
Big word.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Big word. And, I couldn't walk on my own. And so I walked with a walker. And I would say I used a walker for about a month. I ultimately went to a cane, and then I just kind of held on to things, you know, and I will say it still impacts me today. If we're running up, I think they call it the candor of the road.
Oh, yes.
Like even
yes.
here on exposition.
Yes.
Yeah. How it sloped on the side. If I look at that, if I'm looking at it in a way, and my body is moving in a way, it triggers that a little bit. So when I first started running again after all this, that was a huge problem. Now it's a little problem, but it was huge. I couldn't wear a hat. I mean, I'm kind of like you, Carrie. I wear my trucker hat every now and then.
I
always have a hat on, yep. And I couldn't wear a hat.
Just because of the pain from the incision?
No,
the way it changes your
yes,
peripheral.
And it,
yes,
and it impacted my balance too. And so I would say when I started running or like even walking outside, the balance was the biggest hurdle. And along with just building back my muscular strength from, I mean, you know, at that point, it was kind of hard to say is the things I'm feeling in my body from my surgery or from the pregnancy. I mean, I didn't really have a lot of time to, you know, heal from even that. I had a C-section too.
Oh,
so
yeah,
it was like two major surgeries within 3 months. So it was, but, you know, and as far as I had palsy in my face, so,
is that like paralysis or sometimes it can be like a drooping?
Yes, yes, which I definitely had. Whether that was going to be permanent or temporary, we really didn't know. Mm-hmm. I still have a little bit of that. Not everyone would notice. I notice, mm-hmm. you know. But at the time, you know, I would just drool a lot. And when people would come visit me, I'm just like, I had just held a Kleenex here. I'm like, don't mind the drooling. And I mean, I was from what I had been, and you know, this business owner of a of a fitness studio and then a marathon runner. I mean, it was a hard pill to swallow that you then walk in and see me. And I think that's why I wrote the post. Is like, it wasn't, I just needed people to know, like, I just wanted to put it out there. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, we don't have to talk about it. We can. Yeah. I'm an open book, but like, you know, and I don't know if it was that I just kind of didn't want people feeling sorry for me on one level too. But I was in a good place where I was going to try to get better. I remember my first big outing was my friend's, her daughter was turning two and I went to the birthday party. I mean, and that's when I realized, I mean, it just left me. It left me with, I get overstimulated very quickly. I get off balance, you know, that's all a big challenge. But I mean, in the past, I would say 3-4 months, they told me this would happen. One day it's just going to kick in. You're going to really start feeling a lot better. And I think that's starting to happen. I can tell my running is going a lot easier. I don't have as many episodes. I'd be scared of my own shadow. I'm jumping at everything.
Yeah.
I can't even remember routes that we've run 1,000 times. You know, all of this, teaching bar 3 was a huge challenge because you've got the music, you've got mirrors with lots of people. You're trying to talk and move at the same time. You know, I taught a class the other day and felt really good doing that. These are all things I didn't know would come. And it's taken, you know, here we are almost a year and a half. It's almost been a year and a half since surgery. And I don't think some of them will ever go away. I still don't have any feeling in my face, right? On my lower lip and all this is still numb. Yeah. Hopefully I get some of it back. But, you know, again, I count my blessings that I'm walking, I'm running marathons, you know.
I know. And we'll get to yeah. that. I, you know, the whole premise of the show is I could never do that. And you have said a few times now, like just this very driven business owner, this accomplished athlete, this mom, there's so many type A qualities about you. And then suddenly, seemingly out of nowhere, you are 100% dependent on people around you.
Yes.
And I know a few people, probably many, stepped up to the plate.
Yes.
To fill in some gaps when you couldn't do anything. And obviously your husband.
Yes.
being huge. You are a twin.
Yes.
You have a twin sister. Your mom. Yeah. And I might have to cry for a second, but like, you're not drooling, you're crying. Yeah. I'm trying to envision that time that you, that 3 months, your first 3 months with Beau, mm-hmm. when you knew that you were going to have this surgery and you weren't sure the person that you were going to be afterwards. Mm-hmm. And how frightening that must have been, knowing that you have this miracle child and you have to go under anesthesia and not know who's going to come out. Mm-hmm. And then in those days and weeks and months after surgery, and you're talking about you're using a walker. Mm-hmm. You couldn't hold your child.
Right. That's right.
Talk about those times.
It was terrible. Yeah. And I think, you know, and truthfully, Carrie, I am just, this has all been such a blur, so much at once that I truly am just starting to think about these things. It was just last week, I was looking at my husband and I was like, it just hit me. And we're talking almost a year and a half later. It just hit me how much he did. He had a newborn. I stayed in the hospital alone because I knew Beau needed to be at home. No one needed to be staying with me. Our focus was Beau. And and funny enough, when I was in the hospital, we had a storm and a tree fell on our house and the power went out. Oh my God. Beau and my mom and my twin sister and John don't have power for 2 days. And they are, I mean, this is what he's doing. Oh, he's actually taking care of my, I mean, he's taking care of me in the ways that he could. And it's just, I mean, it's mind boggling when I think about it, that how did he do that? And, but they, you know, they'd come up and they'd bring Bo so I could hold him. And they, you know, I wasn't allowed to hold him unless I was sitting down. And, you know, one thing I hadn't prepared for was breastfeeding. I thought I'd be in the hospital. I had pumped enough to get me through 3-4 days. And then I did not know I was going to be there for so long. I didn't know I was going to be on these like massive narcotics. I mean, you know, and not really, and kind of having that taken away from me too. And then John and I having to figure out formula. We'd never done that, you know, and him really doing it on his own at home without me. And so a lot of milestones, and then coming home and not being able to carry Bo or put him in the car or just do anything. I was able to hold him when I was sitting down, and so I could feed him. But mostly my brain was so out of whack. I feel like I missed out because I just don't remember. You know, there was so much going on, and it was almost self-consuming. So at that point in your motherhood journey, you're really all about the baby, right? And mm-hmm. I had to be so about me that I feel like I missed out on some moments. But when I go there, I try really hard not to do that. And what do they say? I mean, I did the best I could at that time.
Yeah. With what you had.
With what I had. It's very easy to look back, you know, and say, I didn't do this. I mean, I can do that all day long. I missed out on this, but like, what was I supposed to do? You know?
We have
a 2-story house. So like I couldn't walk up and downstairs with him and things like this. So, you know, all of it was for his good. But yeah, it's still hard. Still hard to think about that and to think that I missed out on things and maybe got you know, instead of being able to, if he was crying or something, mm-hmm. maybe feeling a little bit more emotional about that than I needed to. But I was at that point, I had zero control of emotions, and this overstimulation thing was real. Mm. I mean, just, and you know, kids, there's a lot of stimulation. And then family all around you. And then gazelles coming by and bringing me meals. You know, I think I still feel so bad that there were some days that I couldn't get out of bed. And then, they had made me this amazing meal, and I couldn't even get up and say thank you to them in person. And me being who I am, that was devastating for me. And so I was just thinking about that this week while I was running, is looking around at these people. And I was like, trying to remember like who came over, who brought me meals, who did these things and started meal train. And my goodness, what, you know, it's just, you wouldn't think this far into it that I'd be thinking about this so much, but I do, because it's all, I think I'm just starting now to get the clarity where I can really, you know, just think about what happened to me and what does that mean and how does that feel? Mm-hmm. And it's a lot of feelings still.
and you, right. And like you said, they'll process and then you'll reprocess and then it'll dull and then you'll have to reprocess it again. But I do think that that's almost miraculous in and of itself, that our body sort of knows how to regulate that. Like your body and your senses knew what you needed mm-hmm. in that moment. And now that you're coming out of it, it sounds like, I don't want to harbor on like guilt or whatever, mm-hmm. like the negative aspect, but what it sounds like is like this profound, profound sense of gratitude for family, friends, life, your child running. And that to me is the byproduct of all of this. And somewhere in the middle of all of this, of this haze that you're in and not knowing what end is up, literally, randomly, out of the blue, it seems, you got an email.
A phone call.
Was it a phone call? And it was from the brain tumor charity asking if you wanted to run.
This is the funny part of all of this.
In all of this, suddenly you get this random phone call from the brain tumor charity asking if you wanted to run the London Marathon. What, it would have been 6 months after your brain surgery?
That's right, yeah.
How did they hear your story? And how did that come to be? Because London, the London Marathon, would have been your sixth major. So
that's right.
You would have, and spoiler alert, yep, did complete that marathon. So how did it come to be?
Yes, that, you know, it is so funny. After everything had happened, I, at one point, we all put our name in the hat in the lottery for the London Marathon. I think this was my fifth time I had tried to get in. And I remember it had to have been after my brain surgery because it was at some point after I'd been diagnosed. I was probably going on to London to check, you know, when's the lottery announcement?
When do I lose again?
Yeah. And you know, at the bottom, I remember at the bottom of the screen, the charities were scrolling like, "What if you want a guaranteed entry? You know, because London is a huge, that's like their biggest charity event, I think, of the year. Like that marathon particularly is charity focused.
Okay,
so. They and the brain tumor charity. I mean, it just popped up, and I was like, I had never applied for a charity, so I was like, well, I'm just gonna click this button and see what. I mean, I just thought that was wild, so I clicked on it, and it just, you know, fill out this quick little application. I just said a little bit about my story, never thought about it again. So when this number was calling me, a United Kingdom number had been calling me several times. And I was like, thought it was spam, whatever. Well, one day I answered it, and it was a woman from the brain tumor charity that said, "We saw your application, and we would like to invite you to run in the London Marathon for our charity." And I said, well, funny thing happened. I actually had brain surgery, and I remember it wasn't more than 2 weeks later. Like, this was with it. I said, I literally just had brain surgery 2 weeks ago and I am on a walker. I can't walk. And unassisted. And she said, oh, well, I understand. And I said, but I could not find it within me to say no. I mean, I'm sitting here, like, I remember I was, Emily, I so went funny. Outside because I was like, if my mother hears me talking, because that's a whole nother podcast.
Yeah.
With my mom, yeah, and me running, you know, but my, I went to the outside and there I am on my walker holding my phone. And I said, I can't tell you no. But I don't know what to say at the same time. And she said, well, I'll give you some more time. It was the holidays by that time, you know, it was November. She said, take till Thanksgiving, think about it, talk to your doctors, talk to your physical therapists, and then we can just go from there. So I thought on it and thought on it, and Thanksgiving Day, I emailed her and I'm like, let's do this. And, I didn't know how I was going to do it.
Yeah.
But I was just saying yes, and I was going to figure out the rest later. I was not going to lose that chance. And again, wow. I think knowing that the tumor could come back, I just could not say no to that. And knowing how hard too it is to get into London, I mean, I didn't know if I'd ever have this opportunity again, and I had to take it.
And it was just so fortuitous because it was the brain tumor charity.
It was. I mean, I was just I just couldn't believe it. And I thought this is, and fun fact, the race was on April 23rd of 2023. And 23 is my number. My birthday, mine and John's birthdays are on the 23rd. There's a whole big 23 in our family. And it was April 23rd, 2023. And I had to do it. Once I made that connection, I was like, I need to do this.
It's going to happen.
It's going to happen. I don't know what it's going to look like. And it did. It looked much different. And in fact, it still sits with me, and it's hard. I have never had this race was just with the brain things, the people. I mean, you know, when you're a marathon runner, you live for these races, right? That have this insane crowd, like the cheering, and like, you know, Boston has a lot of that, right? Mm-hmm. New York. Mm-hmm. You have never seen anything like London. Have you run London?
I've not.
Okay.
No.
You've never seen anything like this. Now, for me at that time, it was horrible. It was exhausting. I just remember running thinking, I just need one second of peace and quiet. And I saw a tunnel, and I'm like, okay, I'll get it at the tunnel. Well, there was a drum line underneath the tunnel. So I was like, okay.
And this was during the race.
And so that's what I found myself. Wow. So I normally, what my mental strength is like, that's my A game, right? That I've always said my success in marathon running is not my physical skill. I mean, watch me run, right? Nothing's natural about that. Got my floppy foot and everything going on. But I have a pretty strong mental game, but that was really hard to find in London. Although my desire to get there, but I just for the first time was like, I don't know if I can do this. You know, I was so tired. I thought with the baby, I remember thinking during the race with the baby, with the surgery, I just don't know that I have any push left in me. And that's when it hit me. And it stuck with me. It's the first time I ever wanted to quit a race, and was really like, I've never understood those people that like have half a mile to go and they stop or something, you know what I mean? Yeah. Or like finish.
And I can tell you all about that.
Yes. I mean, I don't get that, right? It's just not who I am. And I was like, I remember specifically, I can picture it in my mind where I was. And I was like, I'm that person. I've just become that person. And I don't know if I can do this. And truthfully, had I understood how to get to my husband in London when you're 3 miles out from the, I probably would have stopped. That I found a way, and I say often that this was the first time I felt like my experience as a marathon runner actually came into play. I've never thought of myself as this experienced marathon runner or runner in general, but it was my 11th marathon, and I was like, okay, you've got to finish this thing. Let's do a fartlek, you know?
Oh, yes.
So I'm like, okay.
Great mind trick.
1 minute on, or I was trying to do 5 minutes on, 1 minute off, and I couldn't even do that. You know, I was in like a quarter a mile on, 30 seconds off. And I mean, it got down to the point where it was just like run 1 minute, walk 1 minute, you know, but it was the first time I knowingly tapped in to my running experience, my training experience, where I could flip a marathon into a fartlek and make it work, and I finished. Yeah.
Oh my God, there's so many things I want to draw from that. That and like the muscle memory, and you are an athlete, by the way. You are a runner. You're a very accomplished runner, and I love that you were able to sort of turn what seemed insurmountable into something, into digestible chunks of time. And quite honestly, it sounds like that's how you're dealing with the magnitude of what has happened to you over the last 3 years, which is just, you can only process it in these little chunks.
That is so insightful. Yes. That may be why I'm just now like feeling a lot of these feelings. And yes, Carrie, thank you for the therapy session.
You're welcome.
I could have paid a lot of money for that.
Otherwise, it's too much.
Yes.
And that race would have been too much, both from a mental perspective, because it was very overwhelming for you. And it sounds like you're almost going into almost like a panic attack.
Yes, yes.
And physically, it was almost too much for you. How did you even train? So you said yes. Mm-hmm. Let's say December 1, mm-hmm. you say yes, it's Thanksgiving, and the race is mid-April, April 23rd. Mm-hmm. And that's not a lot of time to train for a marathon, especially coming back from your pregnancy, your birth, and your brain surgery and all that. Like, so you were effectively starting from
ground zero.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, you literally were, could not run to the end of the block.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I started with 30-minute online bar 3 classes.
Okay.
And I would use my, and this was just to kind of build up some, like, get my legs moving again. And so I would use my walker, and in bar 3, we, you know, there's lots of squats, balancing exercises. So that's where I started. And I think, if I remember correctly, did that like all, you know, for 3 weeks or so through Christmas. And I think I wanted to do a Christmas run. So I went out on my street and I ran like 1 minute and then walked, you know, probably three. Mm-hmm. And then ran 1 minute. And I remember I got up to, I did that for 2.5 miles. And I remember thinking, I cannot believe I went 2.5 miles. But then on the other hand, oh my God, I only went 2.5 miles. What in the world? And like literally in less than 4 months, I'm supposed to run a marathon. And you know, what's funny though, and again, this is where experience, don't we all kind of have those thoughts?
Oh,
as trained as we are, like you can run a zillion marathons, and I swear, you start training, you go on your first like 12-mile run or something on the weekend, Saturday, and you're like, how am I going to run 26?
Yeah,
there's no way. And you know, and so I know you just do it.
Yeah.
And so every time I ran, I think I was trying to do 3 days a week, you know, and I would just run, try to make that minute longer. Like maybe today I can run 1.5 minutes, or I would do, it was basically a fartlek situation, which is probably why I fell back on that. Mm-hmm. But I was definitely implementing, I found this new love-hate relationship with the run-walk method.
Yep.
It was really working for me, but then I really had to, you know, change. And I think the big event that happened was, so that was January. St. Patrick's Day, so March 17th, I was up to where I needed to do a 13-mile long run at minimum. So I went to Dallas, and I had talked to like Gilbert and my physical therapist, and they're like, because I was getting that, it was challenging walking, running, what that starting and stopping for my body. So they said, why don't you try to run 1 mile nonstop? And then just walk for, you know, 45 seconds, you know, was my game plan. And I did a half marathon that day. And I was, that was being in March. I mean, I was postpartum, you know, 6 months postpartum, maybe.
Just not long.
Not long. Yeah, not long. And yeah. So that's when I kind of had my first thought of like, maybe I can do this, really do this. So, I mean, it was only a month away.
A month
I just increased my long runs by 2 miles each weekend. I was out there for hours. But again, people would, I'd start at like 4 o'clock in the morning because that's how long it would take me. And then like at 10 miles or something, you know, my friend Susan would meet me. I'd meet her at Mopac, you know, mm-hmm. and it was super scary for me. There I was, you know, brains are running in the dark, scared of my, it was like, couldn't see anything. My depth perception was all weird with my brain. So I would be so exhausted by the time I found her. It was just more like, it's not only was she, you know, helping me get through those last miles, but, it was mental and physical. Right. And same, so many gazelles joined me on those runs at the end. Mm-hmm. And, somehow I made it up to 20 miles. I would increase 2 miles But, you know, truth be told, Linda, I wasn't physically ready, right? Yeah. And I mean, that there's probably a lot of that along with the mental overstimulation and all of that. But, I mean, this is like a 2 mile per weekend build to yes. get to 20. There's no doubt. Like, that's not enough mileage. It wasn't enough time. But, you know, how do you do that?
Yeah.
You know, like,
You just one step at a time. Yeah.
And I truly believe, you know, you can make it happen. Now, it may not look like you want it to, but if you have it on your heart, and I believe you can make things happen. We're all so much more capable than we think we are, but you got to feel it and believe it, you know, or you just have to be really stubborn and a type A, like... You know, I am not finishing this race, especially when you spend a lot of money to get there and leave your son. You know, that was another thing. I was leaving.
Did you leave Beau here again? And John went with you.
Yeah, John went with me. And so I was leaving my son again to do this. And that was a whole nother thing. When I felt like I had already left him while I was in the hospital and, you know, in a lot of ways, but you know, I just kept thinking, you know, hopefully you'll be proud of mommy one day and you'll understand why she had to do this, you know? Mm-hmm. So
flexibility, resiliency, adaptability. These are all traits that you have had to employ over the last couple of years in every aspect of your life. So of course it would have had to have happened in your training leading up to the marathon in London. And that is an inherent lesson on how you do things that you didn't think that you could do, which is be open to flexibility, be curious about, great, it wasn't a PR. I mean, really.
Yeah, it was my slowest race of all time.
But dare I say the most meaningful?
Yes. And you know, that right now, it's so heavy on my heart. I'm thinking about it so much. You know, thinking about running Eugene. I at this point, are we a month away again? I probably need to commit one way or another. I mean, this weekend's a 20 miler. You know, you don't do that for nothing. Yeah. But it's been hard. I mean, London's sneaking up on me in my mind, and it's I'm scared. You know, I think I've never been scared like this to run a race. And I think that's why I haven't committed. And, but I'm doing all the training and it's a lot better, you know, but I'm just, you know, a lot of people may have had these experiences at the end of a marathon. Marathons are always hard. It's not like I've never struggled through the end of a race, but this was a different kind of struggle and it scared me. So now I have a little bit of baggage, right, that I'm bringing into my marathon game that I don't think I've had before. And I'm trying, you know, my friend Jennifer, we're both, you know, she's like, I'm making a comeback race, right? And she asked me just last weekend, is this your comeback race? And I thought, you know, it's not. And when I thought about that, it's my progress report, right? Wow. It's when I realize that, and it was just her bluntly asking me that question, some of the pressure came off. Like, this isn't, you know, if I run Eugene, I really just want to go be a part of the group. Again, these things are important to me, you know, socially, like, just do something good for myself and let it be what it is. You know, I'd like to get, you know, I mean, it's going to be a big difference from London, no matter what I do, right? Yeah. We would like to say we don't care about the time, but we do, you know. Right. And but I think it's, you know, so maybe this will make me just sign up for that darn race.
I hope you do. I know hope you're you do. Going. I'm going. Yes. I am going. I think I'm one of like 35.
Yes, and how fun is that?
People that are going to be there.
That's what it's about, you know? And that's, I think that would just, it's such a fun thing to do with friends that you all have the same goals. And you know what I mean? Ultimately, it's just, that's who you want to surround yourself with, you know?
Without question.
Like-minded people.
Yes. And that is why we love our training group so much with the Gazelles, is that we're all coming at this from different perspectives and different backgrounds, and we all have baggage. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I've never been a part of a more supportive group in my entire life. And it's fun. Mm-hmm. It's fun because I like being middle-aged, mm-hmm. and really it alleviates a lot of the pressure that you had in your 30s and 40s to always like PR or try to go faster or try to win practice or whatever, you know, whatever it happens to be. And I don't feel that sense of pressure. Now I'll go out on I'll gut myself, yes. at a workout. Like yes. I will work hard, but it's not, it truly is just for the love of it. And I see you're back at practice, mm-hmm. like you're training and running well. And what is it like to be back with the team and training like a quote unquote normal runner who, after going through what you went through?
I don't know. You wouldn't want to be in my head during all this. Mm. I mean, it's exhausting. I think so much. I think often, you know, especially on long runs where you kind of see everybody, you know, you get roped into your weekly groups, right? Yep. So you kind of see the same people. But I think Saturdays are always a big eye opener for me because I see, you know, I have run with so many people during so many different groups, depending on my speed and what I've been through. At one point I would see like, oh, I used to run with them and there they go speeding off, right? And so I would feel really bad. Like, why am I not there anymore? But I think like you said, being middle-aged now, I mean, I think you can find more value in the fact that I've run with them. I have so many friends and so many people. Like, I could run with anyone. I literally could just start a Saturday long run by myself and run with anyone and that shows the journey, right, of life really and running or any walk of life really. I mean, there's going to be ups and downs. Some days you're fast, some days you're slow, some days your head just isn't in the game and you don't want to push, some days you do. And I think I'm trying to see the value in that and what it's the gift that those, like, okay, I can't run as fast right now, but what is that giving me? You know, it's giving me time out of the house where I'm like, my long runs are a little bit longer these days, which isn't a horrible thing.
Coffee, anyone? Coffee?
Exactly. So, and I mean, but I will say for the first time I'm feeling, and I mean, this has just happened in the last few weeks. I started this marathon training kind of like, bottom end, you know, we'll even see, but you know, I did a 8-mile pace run yesterday and hit the pace I wanted to hit. And nice. It was something I didn't think I could do. I'm starting to feel the muscles engaging again. Yeah. I do have muscles in my legs again. You can't see them yet, but they're there. so I'm kind of feeling it coming back. And I think like just in the last week or two, I'm feeling a little bit more like myself. And it's not that running or even being a studio owner is, you know, we can root these things. It's our identity, you know? And so this has just been a huge shift for me. I sold the studio. My running has obviously taken a major hit. And so it's been a lesson. So I think when you ask me, you know, how does it feel? It's, you know, I have good and bad days. I have those days I kind of beat myself up, but I also have these good days of like, oh my gosh, look what you're doing. Like you're actually like trying to get a BQ again. And like, who knew was even going to be able to do that when I came from a walker, you know? So it's, I don't know. It feels good. Today I feel good. Mm. We'll see how I feel on Saturday.
Right. Or tomorrow's fartlek.
Yes, tomorrow's fartlek. Exactly.
yeah. Emily, this has just been so, it's breathtaking to hear your journey from a firsthand account and know that we see each other and we run quote unquote together And yet, like, I cannot wait to root for you.
Oh, Carrie.
And Eugene. yeah. Yeah. And there are so many lessons that I'm taking away from all of this today and from what has happened to you. And least of which is don't stop believing in yourself and dreaming big. And I do think that no matter what, like some people use these big, you know, tragedies or things as an excuse to stop reaching and to stop trying. And I'm trying to pick my words carefully here, but like, you haven't done that. You have taken this adversity and these blessings on and still finding ways to grow and change and dream big. And I think that's, I'm definitely taking that from me. And so when people say, oh, I could never do that to you, or I don't know how you're doing it, or I don't know how you did it. And your response would be what?
You can. And it may look different. It may look different. And it may be really hard, but you can. And you'll find the joy in that. You will find the joy in that. And you'll find the peace. And that's, you know, but you got to try.
Thank you.
Thank you, Carrie.
And wouldn't you know, after we stopped recording, we must have talked for another 30, 45 minutes about the love of running and the meaning it now holds in her life and our lives. It truly is a metaphor for her last couple of years. You know, sometimes you don't get the race that you want, or you don't have the run that you want, but you always walk away stronger and more accomplished. And you meet some of the most fantastic people with every step that you take. She has no idea what her future health holds. None of us do. But she lives boldly for her baby beau and her family, proving that in those I could never do that moments of despair, a little forward motion is sometimes all you need. Thanks for listening to this independent podcast. You can support I Could Never Do That with a small donation via Venmo or the app Buy Me a Coffee. And I'll link up how to do that in the show notes. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. Take care.